There is St. Paul Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, and you may have read something about him a year or two ago. He tried to join the Dominican order and hold his Methodist ordination and become a monk in the Roman Catholic Dominican order. I don't think it went through, but it tells you, and we'll at the end of this, I'll tell you what theological world he lives in. That's some clue right there, by the way. But what he says is that you can look at your theological world and first of all, with this, the essential rhythms, or another way to say it is in terms of the tensions that exist in a theological world. And then the issue is really, one might say, the context for the rhythms. And how does it? What is the feel that a person has that finds themselves in a particular theological world? And then the most important driving element in all of this is what he calls obsessio. This comes from his definition of the Latin word to mean the being besieged. Another way to talk about this is, what do we see the problem in the world to be? What's the world's predicament? What's its dilemma? Or what's our own personal dilemma that is kind of our life issue, if you will? And then the image or the metaphor of what he calls state here, and again, we'll explain some of that, the sense that grows out of the feeling and out of this obsessio, this dilemma that we perceive. And then finally, what's atonement? What images? He has a wonderful thing in here in which he talks about the fact that the church has never been able to agree on one atonement theory. And part of that is that we've never been able, he contends, and I think he's right about this, to agree on what the problem, what the dilemma, what the human dilemma is, or the dilemma of the creation. And so as a result of that, we can't agree on an atonement theory. Then what's the image of Christ? What's our Christology? Who is Jesus in this theological world? And then finally, the epiphaneia, which is the salvation that comes. Another word for that is kind of the resolution, or maybe resolution is not quite the right word, but what is it that allows us to live with this predicament that maybe begins to make sense of it, maybe finally it gets itself resolved some way or another. Those are the categories that he wants to use. Now, a little promo for this book. One of the wonderful things, when he outlines even the kind of music and the kind of art that give expression to these obsessios, to these epiphaneias, and it's just really a lot of fun, I think, to go through and see how in art and literature and music and all these ways you can hear the rhythms in these various worlds. So the first world that he identifies is one that's marked by the rhythm of separation and reunion. And I think probably one of the easiest ways and the best ways for me to move through this is to give you his definitions, and I want to give you his definitions of obsessio and then of epiphaneia. An obsessio is whatever functions deeply and persuasively in one's life as a defining quandary, a conundrum, a boggling of the mind, a hemorrhaging of the soul, a wound that bewilders healing, a mystification that renders one's living cryptic. Whatever inadequate words one might choose to describe it, an obsessio is that which gets its teeth into a person that it establishes one's life as a plot. So kind of we'll be thinking about what's gotten its teeth into you. And then he goes on to talk about The second pole we identify as epiphaneia, epistemologically meaning to show upon, that which keeps the functioning of an obsessio fluid, hopeful, searching, restless, energized, intriguing, as a question worth pursuing for a lifetime. It keeps one's obsessio from becoming a fatal conclusion that signals futility. I love those definitions, and part of it because of they keep everything moving, keep everything living, I suppose. The first in the theological world that he identifies, the world of separation and reunion. He says, here we have the sense of being an alien. In becoming awakened in this world, one experiences life as having a fundamental arbitrariness. Everything that is could just as well have not been. And a person in, he says that in this world, what renders one alone is the persistence of the one word, why. What difference do I make? I mean, if I weren't in the world, the world would be, I make no difference in the world at all. And so we probably either know in ourselves or someone else who kind of carries this obsessio. What is it what difference do I make in the world? What does my life add up to? Another way he has of putting it, looking at this with all of this with a slightly different glance, two issues appear. The longing is such that one might seek solace in friendships or in the perfect marriage, but it is never enough. And yet, if it were enough, a second issue would become pervasive. It will not last. Thus, not only are we thrown into life, but that which is thrown is very fragile. That's in World One. And then you'll notice as you move across this this sense that this obsessio, this human condition, is one of isolation, experienced as abandonment, mystery, obtuseness, thrownness, opaqueness. One feels like an alien or an orphan. And then atonement comes in the sense that the veil is torn, if even for a moment, so that we know that we matter. Douglas John Hall, in his book, Jesus, A New Vision, has this sense. He says something that I think really addresses the World One, when he says that Jesus, as a disclosure of God, reveals to us that at the center of everything, there is a being who is in love with us and wills the best for us. That's homecoming. And so that's the resolution of this first world. Luke 15 and the prodigal son coming home is epiphaneia.
You probably said, but I missed the author and the title of the book you're talking
about. Yeah, this is W. Paul Jones.
And the book is?
Theological Worlds.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, just again, we'll just run through these rather quickly and then we can have some conversation, and if someone wants to share something that is particularly, that struck you out of this, we'll pick up on it. In world number two, the rhythm is conflict and vindication. And here the issue or the arena is history. And the feeling here is anger. Is why is it that things don't work out right? When Bob has been talking to us about the Southern Hemisphere, about South America, and the injustice that the people in Honduras feel and that whole kind of, this is the world seen in world number two about conflict and vindication. And so this, he talks about normlessness experienced as chaos, enigma, wretched, invaded, oppressed, opposed. And in this world, then the state is that of being in conflict, warrior. And atonement, then, using this this sense about what one would see the work of Jesus to be, the work of God to be, would be that love would be, we would see love as taking our part. And Jesus would be the Messiah, the liberator, and the epiphaneia would be when justice comes, when there is a new world order in which we overcome these divisions, these separations that have been a part of it. Again, just quoting him to, in terms of an obsessio in this world, the world seems to thrive on conflict in which no balance of power stays balanced. The grin behind foreign policy is the thirst for domination. Survival of the fittest is the law of nature, while the fittest in history is a euphemism for exploitation. Reinhold Niebuhr traces the way the early biological necessity of being center becomes an obsession. The drive to be convolutes, at least for most males, into the craving to be the one. In the urban ghetto where I live, to leave one's mark is a deadly preoccupation. In suburbia, it's called a vocation. The night streets are jungles. The marketplace by day is hauntingly similar. The world is one of competition in which winners determine the rules. That's the obsessio of world number two. And then a quote about the epiphaneia. Bonhoeffer proffers the Christian epiphaneia for world two by asking, does the question about saving one's soul appear in the Old Testament at all? Aren't righteousness and the kingdom of God on earth the focus of everything? His distillation of Scripture places it squarely within this world. The redemptions referred to here are historical, that is, on this side of death. For your kind of information, there's a test you can take and figure out where you, I live in world one and world two. And so you're a crusader for peace, justice, and the non-American way or something. But the next world, emptiness and fulfillment are the rhythms. And here the emphasis is upon the self. And you'll see there's some resonance with world number one, but as we get into it, you'll see a distinction between the two. And here we have, in this world, the obsessio is self-estrangement experienced as impotence, not kind of non-being or non-significance, but insignificance, self-alienation, not belonging, lost potential, invisibility. Here the feeling is, the state is that of an outcast. And an atonement in this situation is love as filling to overflowing. And in this model, Jesus is, or in this world, Jesus is an example or model. And what he does is he brings us to wholeness. To pick up one on his definitions. We see not the tragedy of human nature deprived, but the pathos of human nature we see not the tragedy of human nature depraved, but the pathos of human nature deprived. It is psychological asphyxiation, rooted in anorexia of the spirit. We become desperate and alone because that which seems significant for others leaves us gasping. For these walking dead, the nothingness of suicide can take on the appeal of a definitive tranquilizer. In world number three, I am in the room, but no one notices. Then moving on in terms of what is the epiphaneia for this, The passion for fullness must be unlocked, whereby genuine living becomes life in love with itself. If Christianity is to be other than full, it means taking seriously the Jesus of John's gospel, I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. Since the kingdom of God is within you, faith brings wholeness in which one can believe in oneself. One cannot love others if one cannot love oneself. Wilt thou be made whole? Then take up your pallet and walk. Your faith has made you whole. And then moving to the next world four, which is the one that theologically was the cookie cutter that most of us were pressed in, which is condemnation and forgiveness. And the issue here is the demonic. The feel is guilt. And original sin and all kinds of things, as we'll see in a moment, get to be part of this. And the obsessio, or the human condition here, is powerlessness, experienced as idolatry, disease, condemned, falling short, fearful. The state one is in is fugitive. And here, to pick up a literary image of this, the hound of heaven would be a sense of what that's about. And atonement comes when the hound of heaven runs us down. And we are, love is seen here as forgiving the unworthy. And Jesus is the Savior, Redeemer from our sins. And the epiphaneia is adoption or reprieve, forgiveness. And again, picking up, he uses Luther a lot in this material. Do we never do anything helpful? Perhaps, but the issue is motive. No matter how outwardly moral an act, the haunting question is why? To be seen, to receive, to win, to feel better, to gain respectability, or even to earn my salvation? Something like works righteousness, right? And the sense that we are a primal recognition in World 4 is that just to be born is to experience indebtedness. In sin did my mother conceive me? I mean, this is the world that street corner preachers make their living on. And of course, epiphaneia in this world is with such power given to the obsessio, it is no wonder that in World 4, transitions to epiphaneia takes place more from behind than in front. One is neither lured nor nurtured into change. One is broken. Only when one can no longer reach can one be reached. Only when one knows oneself is unlovable can love break in as gift. I mean, Luther, I remember learning law and gospel in the seminary, and Luther's thing that until the word makes you nothing, it can't make something of you. That's world number four. Then world number five is suffering and endurance. And here the issue is life itself, and I'm going to get into this a little bit more in a minute, because I think, again, hooking it up with some of the things that Bob Ekblad's been sharing with us in Third World Things. Here the obsessio, the human condition, is meaninglessness experienced as engulfment, plagued, flooded, controlled, manipulated, wronged. And overwhelmed would be another word here, and the state is victim or refugee, and in this scheme, atonement is love as outlasting with long suffering, and Jesus in this scheme is the suffering servant, the companion, and then The epiphania is literally survival itself, but survival with integrity. Since a quarter of the people in this country are below the poverty level and two-thirds of the Earth's people go to bed hungry if they have a bed, the recruits for World 5 are legion. But the obsessio is not restricted to economics. The ticket to enter can have three words: you have cancer. It is then that the words expendable and terminal begin to take on tender meaning. This world is an amalgam of psychological, social, and metaphysical dimensions experienced with the impact of a conclusion. That's the way things are. But bluntly, it is to recognize life as a predator, so much so that even epiphania brings no radical reversal. It's a matter of keep on keeping on in such a way that living takes on an aura of authenticity beyond pathos. Then this graphic picture. Native Americans understand that this wisdom belongs with aging. This world moves beyond words in the Edward Curtis portraits of Native Americans. The faces of the elders are invincible, plowed and furrowed until there is an earthly belonging beyond question. It isn't that they have answers. Life is not a problem to be solved. What is present is an aura. It is in endurance itself that one touches wisdom, a wisdom that knows better than to attempt articulation. So to be is its own strange answer. Any of you see the film Smoke Signals? I thought of that one about this. Life is something to be endured, and in the enduring of it with some dignity and integrity is the epiphania. Okay, I'm going to stop with those ramblings and see if any of this makes any sense, and then we can delve into some places where it doesn't make sense with maybe some greater depth, and it's kind of a book review in 15 minutes. Rather complicated book, but do any of you see yourselves or anybody you know in one of these theological worlds? He says the most kind of elusive thing to get a hold of is really to pin down and articulate the obsessio. What is it that really has its teeth in us as problematic for life?
It seems like it starts with such a negative beginning, that your faith is driven by negatives. And maybe that is how it is, but I find it difficult because of that. On the other hand, I think I could at different times be feeling longing, anger, aching, guilt, and being overwhelmed.
Yeah. None of us lives purely in one world. That's obvious. But there is usually a core before I did the test, I thought about what are kind of the button issues for me. And, you know, social justice, I mean, there's been a reason why I've hung around Holden, I suppose, for a long time. And so probably we have some predisposition toward two.
I just need some clarification on number one.
Okay.
Can you possibly give some sort of real world example or some caricature of a
I think I can
Yeah. Would that be the one that Borg talks about is the exile paradigm of being a feeling of alienation, of being away from home or
uses the Israel story of going to exile, and that's what it sounds like here in terms of being separated from or exiled from whatever your true self is, and then somehow coming home or coming back to one's community is the salvation.
Yeah, and maybe picking up some of his literary he says, your thing about Star Wars is kind of interesting. Examples of residents in World One are Legion. In cinema, the movie fantasy E.T. is a near parody of this world. Distilled in when the hero finally is able to shape his yearnings with the mere words, E.T., phone home. It is the rhythm that defines the Wizard of Oz in what has become almost a folk liturgy. Of Dorothy, we are told that little girl wishes to cross the desert, but no one has ever done it before. The good witch prophesies the route. It's a long journey through a country, sometimes pleasant and sometimes dark and terrible. And the goal, to return home and to know it for the first time. And then in poetry, T.S. Eliot is a major resident. His wasteland is characterized by our separation from images, which have roots that clutch. In the absence of linear meaning, his expressions of epiphania take on the image of a circle. Obsessio comes in encountering the futility of death's circle in which my beginning is my end. Does that help? And he's got the novels of Hermann Hesse and Thomas Wolfe, Look Homeward, Angel, and You Can't Go Home Again.
Would it be something like Religion of Slavery or something about hoping that this life is only so long and then you can have a better life in heaven or something?
Yeah, he calls that really suffering and enduring.
Oh, okay.
The sense of I wished I could find it. There's one quote that I don't see right now that. Well, yet, he says, the question can be, yet can the question ever be quieted once raised, this question of why? To exist means to stand outside of. Precisely, we are damned to look back or forward, inside or out, to watch, to see, to wonder. And being no longer able simply to participate, we are driven to question. And I think Sandy's observation in terms of how this, probably in my presentation of how the obsessio is so strongly presented here makes it difficult to get into some of this. But again, I think if we can think about our own lives, I like, again, going back to his image, what is it that's got its teeth in us? What causes us, I suppose another way to put it in psychological terms, is kind of our anxieties.
Mm-hmm. When I look at that obsessio on number five, there, through my marriage, through an alcoholic marriage, and I was filled with guilt. And see, so I'm up in there, but yet I felt manipulated.
Oh, yeah.
I was wrong.
Yeah. And if you endured that whole kind of thing and all that, that does very much characterize theological world five. And then you see, I think, Jesus, my God, why have you forsaken me? The one that identifies with us in the midst of that suffering, that becomes a very much an answering companion, somebody who is with us in the midst of this terrible thing that's going on. We endure it. We survive it.
Yes, I feel like I'm a survivor.
Right. and one of the things again, if we had the time, we could go through and look at Bible passages that pick up these images. Because part of what his argument is in this book is that it helps us to make room for people whose basic experience of the problem of life is different than our own. And, you know, I think I mentioned in one of my Bible studies or in conversation with someone around here, in the middle of April, I started to meet with a group of evangelical pastors in our little town, and they all live in World 4, big time. And so their language and everything is always cast in that kind of thing. And so it's helpful for me to be able to affirm the validity of their world. And, you know, my hope is, and I suppose in one sense I even went there as the warrior of World 2. With these justices to correct that, you know, there's more ways to see the world than the way they do. But hopefully the motivation to really understand their world and to validate it. Again, the five alternative rhythms that emerge for the Christian as pure types are held together by a common confession that in Jesus one beholds the face of God. And his argument here is that the Christology of the New Testament, the witness about who Jesus is, can be an epiphaneia to each one of these, but it's going to look very different. I'll give you an example. I can't make heads nor tails of John's gospel. He has what I call pretzel theology. You know, I'm in the Father, and the Father's in me, and you're in me, and I'm in you, and it's just like when you get done, you know, I memorize the text I preach on, and I can hardly ever get through John. It's so convoluted, and for me, and it was Luther's favorite gospel.
Same experience. In our text study, when we get done reading that section in the priestly prayer, somebody always says, "And I am the walrus, ukukaju."
But
it's a line from a John Lennon song, "I am you and you are me and we are he and we are all together, it's I and the walrus," and it just sounds like it.
But you see it, but listen to John, you know, what is somewhere in John 15, maybe it's 14, "I will not leave you orphaned." Now if you live in World 1, you're probably going to be a big John fan, right? But you see, John's not sharpening any social justice axes that I ever saw. But Mark, I mean, there we're going to bind the strong man, right? And I can relate to that.
Here, maybe this isn't the time for it, but I want to know where most... I just have a suspicion that most mainline pastors are in one of these.
Yeah, his argument is that all of us find ourselves primarily in one of these worlds.
Well, I'm just guessing. Most all the pastors I deal with, right?
Yeah. Four. And one of the things I think that we basically have been trained into four. Mm-hmm. And again, without it gets too complicated to go back and ask ourselves, where in church history did that happen, and whose obsessio gave us that? And what's happening, you see, is though I believe anyway, people are suddenly waking up and saying, the terminology of World 4 doesn't fit for me. I can't make it. It doesn't help me make sense of life that I was, you know, I was a sinner at 5:01 April the 7th, 1940 a.m.
I think the other part
when I was
that,
born, see?
Yeah, what? And I think the other part of that is that we know that people don't do very well if they don't have a good self-image. Mm-hmm. And maybe if it's only that God gives you that good self-image, Maybe that is all, but it doesn't seem to feel real good. And especially especially like even for a woman to hear that in sin you were conceived, you know, your mom conceived you. It doesn't work real well for me.
So you don't want to live in world four?
Charlie, it seems like a lot of the current sort of theological conflict is between two and four here in terms of sort of more classical theology of four, and then I would say most liberation theologies and feminist theologies are pretty well, at least have got some of two in there, although I think that folks who are really concerned with sort of psychology and healing and theology might be more in number one in terms of that.
When he identifies some theologies, the answering theology of world number one is neoliberalism. And the kind of sense about what, you know, what, how that portrays Jesus and all that. In world two, it's liberation theology. In world three, let me see, have to look, and he has a neat system for all of these, and process theology. Process theology says that everything, I mean, even God and God's self is still becoming. And Alfred North Whitehead is the proponent of that sense about that. You know, God takes seriously what's going on in the world, and so there's this kind of continuing process moving toward the rhythm of emptiness and fulfillment. And then, of course, for world number four, it's neo-orthodoxy. And I don't remember the last one is... existentialism.
World five seems most similar to kind of a Native American view of.
Yeah, it is. It's he contends. I mean, he argues that it is. And again, if any of you were here, not tonight, but last night when Bob Ekblad did his thing and his reflection on the theology of the people of South America that he deals with about it's God's will. Sandy and I have been to Tanzania twice, and I keep telling people, I do not know in the church I meet over there whether I'm meeting fatalism or incredible faith. It's God's will. And they endure, and they struggle. I mean, that really is world number five, that...
Is that a response to colonialism, you think, or exploitation, or is that, it seems to me that the best of Native American spirituality might be number one. I don't know.
The cosmos and mind.
Yeah. Well, I'm not enough of an expert because this is just kind of preliminary stuff, but it's kind of interesting to begin to puzzle through that.
Yeah.
And I want to say a very positive thing about the answering theology in five in a minute. But Jerry, did you have something?
Does it talk about how you move between these theological worlds? With the process, is that the goal of the book, or is the goal of the book simply to try to recognize these theological worlds and identify them? Or is there a step where a recognition of what it takes to move between them? Change?
Yeah, he talks a little about conversion, but that's not the aim. As I read the book, the aim of the book, and here's the trick of the book, is the affirmation that each of these five theological worlds is valid. Mm-hmm. And the part of the difficulty that I have is that the answers, and let's go to our favorite whipping boy, number four. I suppose because they weren't as helpful to me as they might be, that I have some trouble really getting in touch with you know, use my friends from Port Angeles, whom I meet with, and you know, and they live in this world, and boy, it's hard to affirm the validity of that world, and that if we're going to in one sense, validate and give expression to people whose lives, for whom, I mean, there's a good reason why people go to Pentecostal churches, not just as we suspect that they're getting manipulated. But there actually is some epiphania that happens there that answers their obsessio. And maybe they need to go and accept Jesus every 2 weeks or whatever, and however disdainful I might be of that, I need to move to the place where I have some, you know, and we also need to get to the place where we have, I love this in terms of our relationship with the Reformed churches when the ELCA decided that they were okay and we could commune with people like Dan, that it was time for mutual affirmation and admonition, that we could admonish one another. But we've been spending all of our time admonishing one another in these different worlds, and I think it's time to get to the affirmation of it.
And Charlie, I'm just wondering if even in our own liturgical service, doesn't it go through more than one of these in terms of, you know, separation? We at the meal, we get what we say is forgiveness. We, you know, I think.
Well, the fun thing to do would be to go through the Lutheran Book of Worship or with one voice and find out how many different worlds the hymns live in. What about Morning Cry? Where does that fit?
That just is so positive that it's hard for me to be
But the positive is the answer to the obsessio. That's the point.
Yeah, that's with the companion God all through life.
Yeah, because is there not, did John write anything about forgiveness? I mean, that's not a big theme in Morning Cry, right? So it answers to a different theological world.
And even when you were in, isn't there one line in there that when I went wandering away, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I'm still mm-hmm. present with you.
Just tonight, there was a gal I know sat across from us, and every time I was singing a song, I looked over at her and she wasn't singing. So then afterwards, I asked her, I said, "How come you weren't singing?" And she said, "Oh, they were boring songs. They didn't even turn me on." And I haven't sang Abide With Me for so long. I thought it was just...
And where does Abide With Me? I mean, of course, it's got, you know, it lives in a couple of these worlds, I think, but...
It's a companion.
Yeah.
You didn't give a theological definition to number 5 like you did to the other 4 categories.
Oh, it's existentialism. Yeah. Are they doing much existential theology anymore, Dan?
In the historical category. Sort of, you review 20th century theology, you go with your existential.
Yeah. Well, let me share just one other thing, and then we'll it's time to close. And again, I think this probably says as much about my theological world as and or maybe temperament, because I mean there's all kinds of ways to slice ourselves. It says, whether people serve themselves or serve others is not in their power to choose. This is decided wholly in terms of the kind of world that they see ruling the roost. The issue lies at the level of the God they worship and not in the kind of person they might want to be. In New Testament terms, they live according to the king that holds them and the kingdom to which they belong. That's a very interesting observation, and I want to want to leave you with just a thought. And I've shared this already here, but when I was in Sunday school, I always wondered why folks got all irritated and the Bible did about idolatry. And I came to the conclusion that it makes all the difference in the world what kind of God you have, because you become like the God you worship. And so I think as we think about the theological worlds we live in and how that shapes our understanding of God, we have here a potential for enormous help, but also for more idolatry. Because it's possible for us to shape a God according to our needs and not simply see in the fullness of Christ the God who meets our various needs. And so that's why, again, I think in the church, if we could learn to live in the kind of mutuality of admonition and affirmation. I mean, I need to learn something, and I already have from my evangelical brothers. But I have a sneaking suspicion they have something to learn from me. And so, hopefully and I think again, you know, what Joan said at the beginning of this about in a world that has so little patience. I mean, we say, we claim pluralism and all of that, but it's so shallow. Long as you don't bump into me, do whatever you like. I mean, that's fine. But when we start to engage one another, then we don't have much level for acceptance, let alone tolerance. And the church needs to get to that place where we can really honestly say, I affirm the world you live in. I don't understand it. It doesn't blow my hair back what I've got left or whatever. But that would be a great service to the church if we could be this variegated community that has, five branches on the tree of life, and each one producing its fruit in due seasons. Okay, I hope this will be enough of a thing to whet your appetite to look at this book. If you have any literary or musical or artistic kind of bents, you'll also find this book utterly fascinating for the way he looks at music expressing some of these worlds, or art, or literature.
Or movies, apparently.
Movies also, yeah. Okay, thank you.